native to the area in particular. So even if it's successful, you may stop erosion, you can produce what is aesthetically a completely acceptable situation. There's no nasty after effects will follow, but nevertheless, you have created a community which is not native to the area. And obviously, as you can see from Professor Johnson's talk, that introduces a factor which is going to have a whole series of chain effects. So I personally think that it is highly desirable that somebody somewhere, whoever's responsible, sits down and works out just what are the really top-notch areas from a wildlife point of view, and attempt to answer Dr. Whedon's question. I think personally, as I say, my own point of view, that this is something that's highly desirable. And finally, I'm just going to put it back on my oil industry hat. I can't resist having one knock at Dr. Whedon before I pack up. And that is that he did mention that he'd like to see the cost of environmental protection and repair internalised within the industry. I must point out that to a large extent this is being done already. There's probably more money being spent on ecological and biological research in Alaska than has ever been spent in any other country in the world in association with a pipeline or oil field development. And I think on that note I will leave it there. There's an awful lot of other things I would like to discuss, but there isn't the time to do so.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sage. You're the only one, I guess, who has mentioned pollution and money as if they were somewhat related. We now call on one of our Alaska boys, Dr. Keith Van Cleve, who has been incidentally carrying on some experimentation to see what can be done toward restoration of tundra, although I don't think that's the subject that he will discuss now.
Well, I'd like to bring up several points, and Larry, one of them is that on the bright side of things, the oil industry is.
Do you want to pass the microphone now?
The oil industry is supporting actively a research project in cooperation with the University of Alaska that deals with problems associated with the restoration of damaged tundra and taiga surfaces. And the study in brief involves evaluation of procedures which may be employed in reconstructing areas where surface vegetation or organic matter have been removed during these construction activities. And experimental sites have been set up at 5 different locations between the Yukon River and Prudhoe Bay. And additional areas will be established between Fairbanks and the Yukon. And while obviously not all habitats can be covered in this proposed study or in the study, the sites were selected to represent major vegetation soil complexes in these regions. The treatments applied at each site, combined with laboratory evaluations of soil, growth potentials of plant species that are native as well as possibly introduced in the forms of seeds, and the use of artificial amendments to stimulate plant growth and surface recovery, hopefully will provide some critically needed answers to questions of land surface restoration in these Arctic and subarctic areas. I'd like to make another point, and this concerns the activities that Dr. Johnson alluded to. A great deal is known about the dynamics of soil plant animal systems in the Arctic tundra, and on the basis of information obtained in the analysis of ecosystem program of the IBP, this work will hopefully be extended to other areas in the Arctic. At the same time, a similar research program, integrated research program, is needed in the taiga to tie together many of the fragmented but interrelated research activities that are now being carried on here. And the third point I'd like to make in closing actually is a question. I would like to know if any information is available on the rates of degradation of petroleum when it is deposited as a contaminant in the marine environments. Maybe there's somebody in the audience that can answer this. I don't know of any information along these lines. Those are the extent of the comments I have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Van Cleve. And you now thank the various speakers for their interesting talks and the discussions as well. Return now to the patient audience and see what they may wish to ask by way of comments or questions, which if in presenting a remark or a comment, if you will please stand and shout the words clearly and hopefully intelligently, so that they may be answered by one of the designated speakers.
I'll try Russell Bell. But one, I wanted to point out that one of the horrible examples of seismic work that was photographed was the carefully designed experiment on improving seismic techniques, and it was approved after full consideration of the surface values that were involved there. So this was an experiment for experimental purposes. It was approved by the state in that area. I did have a question or two. I wonder, Dr. Wheaton, if the biologists can or have done anything to that would concretely identify biophysical areas that might be reserved or that might be close to surface entry. The state in its leasing can lease the subsurface without leasing the surface. So biophysical areas can be protected if you know where they are, but they have to have the knowledge of where they are and the nature of the restrictions put on. These things can be done if the biologist can identify them. And one of the things that's sought by public land administrators is information along that line. And it's darn hard to come by unless I have to look in the right places. A point that Mr. Evans made, that I think is worth a little comment also, is that any oil company operating on state leases is operating under conditions that they have to abide by the state laws, whether it be pollution laws or others. And if they or their subcontractors or agents are violating state laws, they're placing themselves in jeopardy of having their leases pulled. So an oil company won't stand still very long when you say you're placing your leases in jeopardy. We've had occasions when 24 hours is all it took to straighten up an operation that was being carried on in violation of state law under a state lease. The subcontractor wasn't following the orders of the company, and when it was called, the company's attention, it straightened out, and straightened out very quickly. Now these devices can be used. They can be used more freely than they have been in the process, but I know they'll work.
Dr. Whedon, can you give an answer as to the designation of areas particularly worthy of biological preservation for their biological or recreational or intellectual value?
2 points very quickly. Yes, some biological reconnaissance and inventory has been done. Some continues to be done, although the funding for the same is not adequate. Secondly, biologists are not the only people who should be doing this work. It should be done by people with other points of view and other specific interests in these renewable resources. And I would say that private interests in recreation and conservation in general and aesthetics should be involved in the identification of these areas.
I think it's a very good comment.
I am a resident, Sam Wright is my name, and I am a resident of the Brooks Range, and ecological impact of Harding development brings up an immediate question to me. I am very well aware of the effects that the studies that are going on right now are having on my home base. Mr. Page's crew has been in my area. They're fine young men, scientists. But again, I have had to clean up debris, which I just finished cleaning up. And I'm a part of the ecology as much as I can be in the area present. I haven't my winter meet yet, but I should begin it. I'm a biologist. I'm a professor, clergyman. Interested in the aesthetics. I have made my home in the Brooks Range and expect to stay there and be heard from there. Now, the point of this comment is that we keep projecting into the future, which is fine, but right at present, in what we are doing and how we are functioning in the area, the ecology is being disturbed and already is disturbed for the future. Somewhere we have to begin where we are right now. Comment that I would like to raise specifically in terms of ecological impact in Harding development. As you said earlier, the scientists themselves have been part of the problem, and I am a part of the problem. Is it possible for us to begin right now, even here, in this kind of discussion, to raise the questions of our own activity here now? This is a part of the ecology in the Brooks Range. Now, my other response to the question that was raised over here and specifying an area, make it very clear, I think that the Brooks Range itself, and I include the whole mountain range with the exception perhaps of a little over on the west coast and the Seward Peninsula, should be set aside as the last great wilderness in our commons. And in any way you can, make that move, because this resource right now may be a valuable one only in terms of recreation today, but in the future it may be worth all the oil that will ever pump out of the north. We have protected the oil in the north, not as people, but by coal and isolation. Nothing can be protected that way anymore. It is up to us. And so I raise this question right now. Is it possible for this kind of a symposium to come up with some overall program that is definite and not just a discussion? No, we can't do it here. But to make some general statement, and the one I propose is that Brooks Range be preserved as an ecological, biological, and aesthetic resource for our children and our children to come. I didn't even make a speech, but I lived there. Emotionally involved with
which we fix. I think that's a very, very good. I can't think of what explicitly this symposium or this meeting can accomplish there, but I think it would have an influence if it were in the mind of large numbers of this audience, if they would raise their hands, if they feel that there should be a greater amount of land in the state of Alaska set aside as a durable, not necessarily permanent, but a durable refuge which for a long time will not be immediately disturbed. Would you like to indicate your sentiment that in that way? It seems to me on a hasty look that there is a profound sentiment toward preservation of wild or natural or enjoyable lands, and that perhaps with the presentation of that common sentiment here would reinforce the efforts of our stalwart officials who are concerned, both in the oil companies and in the federal and in the state agencies, toward the wise utilization of our lands. Are we other questions or comments? If not, then I think I'll take your expression of thanks to the various speakers and ours in return to this very intelligent and patient audience.
Thank you.
need. I just didn't have it.
What we hope is an interesting panel to give you this evening on a subject listed, the community planning communities for the North. We worked this out with Mr. Fisher, who was quite helpful in helping us to arrange it. We can't help but feel that the large economic growth that's in prospect for Alaska and Canada, aided very much, of course, by the large oil finds, that community planning for the North has become a most important subject. We must get away from the past. The communities that do develop must be planned with a great deal more logic and thought that they have had in the past. They must take a maximum advantage of the best that the terrain and the climate offers. They should certainly concentrate on community life in the North, some of its deprivations, so that this life becomes more pleasant and enjoyable. And in this planning, of course, the environment must have protection. Most of the present villages, if not all of them, just grew with little or no thought for in their development. And to straighten these communities out will be very costly and probably impossible to get them on a planned basis. This session's presentation are really aimed to generate on this important phase thought in the changing north. And the panel's agenda has some logic to it as it's set forth. First, to give you a view of the present village situation in both the Canadian and the Alaskan North. Some views have been obtained from Russia and Scandinavian countries, which don't necessarily represent the kind of community that we have to contend with in Alaska. To give reasons why this development in the north can be expected, to comment on the social and perhaps psychological influences that affect community planning, and to define many of the engineering problems that need consideration in such planning. At the end of the panel, we had hoped to obtain and do have some conceptual ideas which we will attempt to give you with the idea of thought generation. We trust, if we have time, that these conceptual layouts will generate questions and ideas from you folks. Now, there have been a few changes in the people that finally could get here, as listed on your program, and I want to cover these. Mr. Morgan and Mr. Kerr, Canadian members of the panel, found that they were unable to attend. And Mr. Carl Stairs, who was also on the program at the last moment, found he would not be able to come. And Mr. Robert Armstrong of the Engineering Division, North Department of Indian Affairs, Ottawa, of which Mr. Stairs is the chief, is representing Mr. Stairs. The only other person that I should introduce to you, I believe, is Ms. McCabe with the Alaska State Housing Authority, who we have put on the panel in the interim. This is an error that she has not shown on the program. So with that introduction, I think that we'll get to the first item on the agenda. Mr. Edwin Crittenden of the firm of Crittenden, Cassata, Worm, and Cannon of Anchorage will give some views of present development.
Thank you, Mr. Jory. Ladies and gentlemen, my part of the program is very easy, very straightforward. It's going to be punching the button for slides. But also, to start the program off and more comfortably for the rest of us, I'm going to sit down first and read you one page, hoping that the rest of the people will also sit and be comfortable when they give their presentations. You didn't know that was coming, did you, Ron? There are various definitions of the North, the High North, the Middle North, the Arctic. Some are not as important as others. They're not important in discussion of communities and community design, as much so as are the facts of isolation, temperature, population, culture. Communities that will be shown in these slides vary from 61 degrees north to 71 degrees north, or approximately. Villages in one longitude at 61 north may be far more arctic than at 70 degrees north in another. Villages of southwest Alaska are more remote, more isolated, subject to more severe environment than communities at the top of Scandinavia, with year-round open water and daily steamer service. The tree line and the line of permafrost, the end of highways and railroads, are more definitive of the far north. Air transportation changes some of that, at least for the government employee and the resource extraction crews. There will be slides from the east and the west of USSR, from the north of Finland, Norway, and Sweden, from Frobisher to Old Crow in Canada, and Barter Island to Bethel in Alaska. There are native villages, small resource camps, and administrative communities. This is not a definitive collection. I borrowed some of the slides from magazines, or rather I should say I stole them. Others I have gotten from some members of the panel. So we'll go on with the slides.
We got the lights in the first slide.
We have the lights off, please.
I'm supposed to talk and show slides for 10 minutes. To do this means I'm going to flick, flick, flick through. I can't pronounce the Russian community, so I won't try. However, this is in Kamchatka, and it's called a fishing village. Most of these slides came from the embassy in Washington through the news service. This is in Middle Siberia, and I think it's more of what we expect to see. The rest of the slides will not be what we expect to see, I believe. Yakuts, I'm afraid the best part of this, which is up off the top of the screen, the new part of Yakuts is not shown. The same community, the caption under this one is, in effect, that we are fighting permafrost, we're on piers above the ground, that solves the permafrost problem. These units are built of brick. Usually we build with prefabricated units. This is a community, and I think some of these are in backwards, but it doesn't matter, that is supposed to be under construction in the middle north, but it represents, according to the news release that I had, an effort towards total community, in that they have interconnecting corridors to schools, nurseries, shopping, and so forth. It's a housing unit of about 1,000 people. This is Murmansk. And now we go to what is proposed. I'm afraid my slides appear to be in the background, but I don't think it makes much difference. There will be more of this later on in the evening when we have the slides and other discussions on concepts. This is Kiruna in Sweden. It's the most northerly community in Sweden. It's entirely a mining town. I don't know how I did this, and I apologize. This is also Kiruna, designed by Ralph Erskine, an architect operating out of Stockholm. You'll see some other of his work later. Again, backwards, but the concepts are still there. This is Sapavara, which is about 20 miles from Kiruna. It's the first unit in carrying out the plan that just preceded this. It's the back wall of the community. later we had some discussions that I hope the right side around. You know, I did try these slides through and they were right the first time, or else I was wrong. A typical Norwegian fishing community on the Arctic, it's Vardø. I hope they show better for you. This is Hammerfest, the most northern of the Norwegian towns, somewhat south of Point Barrow. Again, Hammerfest with 180-unit apartment building built back into the hillside. Perhaps some better pictures, which were taken from the magazine, showing that this curves back into the hill, in contrast to the Sapodak pictures and the works by Erskine. This has parking below, has a small shop in it. Its intent, of course, is to maximize the summer sun, whereas perhaps the other work of Erskine is to maximize the winter sun. Another picture showing them. Are these in focus?
Yes.
We'll try the next one and see. Now, this happens to be in both Danish and English. How's that? We're in Greenland now, and this is typical of some of the newer but do-it-yourself type of housing in Greenland. I'm indebted to Governor Christensen for these slides, and quite unfortunately, I'm not able to show the colored slides that he sent because they don't fit on the projector. This is temporary workers' housing. Most of the construction in Greenland that is not undertaken by the Greenland themselves is done by imported Danish labor. This is in Gotland. This is a small community farther north, typical, however, of some of the old apartment units, or the Scandinavian, say, terrace housing. We are now at Frobisher Bay. This is a site for a housing development, or excuse me, a complete community center development. It's under construction now. The site is thanks to Bob Armstrong. This is from the site looking into the existing community of Frobisher Bay. This is the proposed complex. It consists of a high-rise apartment structure, a hotel, and an apartment units, and commercial center. I understand that it's being enlarged because of the commercial demand. This is conventional construction on a rock base. Where is this bus? This is Repulse Bay.
This would happen when you put the building in the wrong place.
Shows some of the problems of not being aware of moving the snow and wind. Rankin Inlet. And understand that this was primarily a mining town, built as a mining town, and largely abandoned to the mining operations, leaving a workforce of approximately 80 trained natives. This could be most anywhere, but I think it's Pelly Bay. And this is the community some years later after the Canadian government assisted in the development and housing. I'm going to have to keep moving. This is Inuvik on the Mackenzie. You see the delta in the background. This is an interesting picture. It shows, although part of it's missing, the duplicate school facilities operated, and duplicate hospital now, I believe, operated by the Catholic Church on one hand and Protestant Church on the other. Again, this picture, they're all backwards, but it makes no difference to those who haven't been there. This is Inuvik showing the hospital in the foreground right, the research center just beyond, private housing in the circle. On the left-hand side are apartment structures, and beyond is the shopping area, the headquarters, the hotel, and the native community. They have here the sanitary and non-sanitary community, and I hope I'm not hurting anybody's feelings. The native area is non-sanitary because it doesn't have plumbing. The power plant, with the start of the Utilidor, carrying water from a lake, waste to a lagoon, and steam to houses, high pressure. The apartment houses and this, I call it a sty, but I guess it's a style. Anyway, it's an obstruction. This is the town of the Clavick that was supposed to have been replaced by Anubi. This is Old Crow and the Porcupine. We're getting closer to Alaska. Barter Island, how's that? And that's all I ever saw of Barter Island, maybe. Prudhoe Bay. A backwards proposal that Atlantic Richfield and Humble Oil are now building at Prudhoe Bay. The housing units on the left really belong on the right. They're all interconnected by Utilidor, the water treatment plant, the waste treatment plant, the garages and warehouses are all tied in together. This is the housing unit, a sketch, but it does indicate the construction. It's made up of 10 by 40 by 8, if my dimensions are right, trailerized units that are piled up together, trailer size. This is Browerville at Barrow, and Civilization at Barrow, and if you look carefully, you can see the gas pipe going up and over the street and back there. You can list everything that's wrong that's there. Whittier, you may hear about later, hardly Arctic, but it looks Arctic. Nome, backwards again. Kotzebue, and my best picture of all coming up just after this. This is Scammon Bay and Kivalina. That's the Arctic in pictures, at least as far as communities are concerned. We have the lights now.
Thank you, Ed. We will reserve questions until the end of the program, just to save time and keep the program moving. The next speaker is Mr. Joseph Fitzgerald, known to a great many of you, I'm sure, through his many activities in the state. He presently is Director of Community Relations with Atlantic Richfield Company, Oil Company, but for a number of years was Chairman of the Federal Field Committee in Anchorage. And as noted, Mr. Fitzgerald will talk on the why, where, when, and who of communities in the North.
Thank you, Warren. I must say that I can read upside down, but I can't read backwards, and I suppose that's the real difference between an architect and an economist. If I get things upside down, you don't know, but if I take the economy backwards, you do know. I have a paper, but I should say in beginning, the real impact of oil in the North, community development-wise, is not what I'm going to talk about. It's on Fairbanks and Anchorage. This is where the money is being spent. This is where the major impact is being felt. There are things that I'll point out in the paper. I hope you'll cross-examine us about it, because I don't think any of us know too much about this subject. This is frankly speculatum mentis, and maybe not very much mentis. As a panel discussion, we are focusing on Arctic communities and how they may develop to meet the needs of an emerging economy. My specific role is to deal with the why, where, when, and who of such communities, and particularly to forecast the general direction that community growth may take in Alaska. We have chosen a panel approach to the question of planning communities for the North, for no one knows or can effectively speculate upon the whole range of disciplines involved in determining the need for and the design and operation of communities in the North. I'd also point out that this panel is truly an international one, with participation by several of our Canadian colleagues. Although our experience in Alaska may parallel or diverge from that of Canada, depending on how the areas of the two countries develop, such basic factors in terrain and climate are similar and will pose the same problems in the design and construction of communities. And after looking at those pictures, I might say the same problems in cleaning up. By way of background, it's probably useful to note that there are approximately 7,750 people living in 18 villages scattered across 158,000 square miles of the Alaskan Arctic, an area bigger than Montana and comprising 27% of the land area of the state. Almost all of these people, that is 7,190 of them, are native, and their culture and ways of life are largely those of their ancestors. It was not until World War II that the white man with his alien culture penetrated the Alaskan Arctic. At that time, the threat to the North American continent brought the military to Alaska, leading to the construction of a system of airports, which in time became the basis of an air transportation network, giving convenient access to the Arctic for the first time. In the post-war period, the strategic location of Alaska vis-a-vis Russia led to the construction of a number of specialized defense installations in the North, and these were accompanied by a number of related civilian activities, such as the operation of air navigational systems and weather forecasting. Such activities, however, do not involve many people and have had remarkably small impact upon community development in the North. After a century of American rule, the Arctic is still an empty land. It is now clear that change will come in a major way to the Arctic only as a result of resource development. Oil is obviously the resource which can cause major changes in the next few years, and this poses all of the complex and novel problems of living and working under extreme climatic conditions along the Arctic coast. But of longer range, and probably ultimately of greater impact, is the development of copper and other mining along the south slope of the Brooks Range. In addition to being an entirely different and more equitable part of the Arctic, such development will lead to larger communities with a more normal range of community services. Resource development in the Arctic will also have a major impact upon existing native villages, by providing cash incomes which can be used to upgrade the living conditions of these people to the reconstruction of their villages. As a footnote, we might add the decision by the federal government to establish a gateway to the Arctic National Park would have a greater impact in opening Arctic areas to the general public, if only on a seasonal basis, than all foreseeable resource development. There has been considerable speculation and dreaming regarding the construction of modern communities in large size in the Arctic, on the unstated assumption that development, wherever it occurs, leads to the same kind of urban growth. In my opinion, nothing could be further from the truth. Most people do not choose to live in the Arctic if they have a free choice. The climate is too harsh and the winter is too confining. Moreover, costs are high, and only certain raw materials can be extracted at a competitive price. Thus, we must conclude that Arctic areas will be developed for a very specific reason only, to get out a resource. In addition to restricting the area of economic activity, cost control, what things should be done at the site and what can best be done elsewhere. This produces a very specialized community. Thus, the pattern of development will emphasize the use of advanced technology in every labor-saving device, the employment of highly skilled technicians, the importation of most supplies and equipment, including whole plants, and a heavy dependence on rear supply areas. The labor force will, in whole or to a major extent, live elsewhere and be assigned to the project for a period of duty, after which they'll rotate out for a period of rest. This type of development leads to a very simple infrastructure with heavy dependence on a sophisticated and elaborate supporting transportation system. The oil industry is a perfect example of this development pattern. There are a number of major oil companies now operating on the North Slope, and their numbers will be increased after the September 10th land sale. Each company has its own landing field and base camp, with temporary camps at drilling sites. The base camps are self-contained and accommodate several hundred people. As the oil fields become fully developed, the base camp of each company will continue to be a self-contained communicating community, accommodating all field personnel. There will not be a central community serving all countries, as the backup areas and the location of management and supporting industries will be at Fairbanks and Anchorage. The only exceptions that I foresee would be the possibility of some form of port development or the establishment of a community to serve as a forward staging area in the event that a railroad is built to the North Slope. Under the latter circumstances, a town of considerable size would be required to accommodate the personnel needed in the transportation system and to carry out related supply services for the oil industry. As I believe that a railroad will ultimately be constructed, I also believe it would be desirable to carry out research regarding such a community at the same time that planning is done for the railroad. Since the oil industry will probably rotate its employees out for a period of rest after a period of duty at the slope, and as it will employ a large number of natives, I think we can also anticipate a major impact on such native communities as Barrow. It is conceivable that providing substantial employment to natives in local communities, we can supply the economic means, that is cash, to permit the proper upgrading of these communities. This could be the most important community development problem in the North in the foreseeable future. Again, this is a technical matter which should be studied, and I'd hope that somebody such as Asha could undertake this work rather promptly. The hardest problem is to determine to what extent native villages may spring up spontaneously adjacent to one or more of the oil camps in the North. The oil companies have mineral rights only, and they do not control the land beyond the confines of their airfields and camps. If natives seek to live in the area and develop small communities, they are fully entitled to do so, and it might be helpful to have some sort of general plan available for their guidance. Development of such communities would seem to be more likely to happen if a railroad is not established in the Arctic, or if the system of rotating employees from native village to the field is unsatisfactory. But this is an area in which it must be conceded that they're only educated guesses and not much solid fact in which to proceed. Unlike the Arctic Plain, the south slope of the Brooks Range does not present a harsh and inhospitable climate. Those who've lived at Bornite, for example, consider it a much more pleasant area in which to live in winter than Fairbanks or any of the communities along the Yukon or Kuskokwim Rivers. Discounting individual prejudice, the development of a community of considerable size in this area is not regarded as imposing intolerable living conditions upon the people, even if they remain there on a year-round basis. It also must be recognized the copper industry, unlike the oil industry, uses a large workforce, and this normally leads to the development of a community of 5,000 or more people. In addition, the volume of shipping, both in and out, is very high, and a considerable number of people would be employed in providing the supporting transportation services. Undoubtedly, mining will begin slowly, probably with the opening of a single site, but the operation would be on a rather massive scale, as mining in the North is only profitable on a large-scale basis. It must be recognized, however, that the potential for large mining ventures in the Brooks Range is so great that for planning purposes, we can look forward to a whole series of such operations. Each of these would require its own supporting community. Our planning should therefore contemplate communities of 5,000 to 7,000 people strung along a railroad system across the entire length of the Brooks Range. Any extensive operating of mines across the Brooks Range could ultimately lead to the expansion of such coastal communities as Nome, Teller, and Kotzebue. There is high interest in offshore oil and mineral production in Norton Sound and along the coast of the Bering Sea. The shipping generated by these activities could be augmented by the extension of a rail system in the coast, which could have a very beneficial effect on the economies of all existing coastal communities. The degree and means of public entry into the Arctic is a matter of great concern. The Arctic plain is so fragile in summer that a good argument can be made for limiting access to air or railroad with no public road connection with the rest of the state. On the other hand, the Brooks Range itself, as one of the most beautiful mountain systems in the world, has great potential as a tourist center. It is with these concepts in mind that the National Park Service has proposed a gateway to the Arctic Park on the south slope of the Brooks Range. Such a park would require a road connection as well as a railroad connection, and would undoubtedly attract more people than would otherwise get into the northern parts of the state. If this happens, there would be the normal development of facilities along the highway, as well as the need for lodges and so forth in the park. This is not community development in the orthodox fashion, but we would recommend that serious consideration be given to it. The public will want access to the Arctic, and to confine entry to mountain areas that can withstand excessive use would be a wise conservation practice. Indiscriminate highway development to the north slope, on the other hand, would inflict environmental damage that would be most difficult to repair. In summary, and with some consideration of the order of priorities which should be observed in planning, we should look first at the development of a major transportation hub serving the oil industry on the north slope. We must next examine the impact of oil development on existing native villages and deal with the problem of new villages springing up adjacent to base camps in the oil fields. Finally, we must start to plan for mining communities in the Brooks Range, or they will be permanent, medium-sized communities where people will live on a year-round basis, and they should not be company towns. I have sketched only briefly the possibilities for community development in the north, as the main thrust of this panel must be on the problems associated with community development, which is the subject to be covered by the other panelists. I would now like to let my fellow panelists tell you how we should design and build communities that fit into the Arctic environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Very, very fine paper. Professor Leonard B. Siemens, Executive Secretary, the Center for Settlement Studies, University of Manitoba, Winnipeg. I believe that Professor Siemens has digressed somewhat from the noted subject, but with his experience and background, I'm sure he has a very interesting message from the Canadian viewpoint. Professor Siemens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier on, when I was approached on this, I was requested to say a few words about the Center for Settlement Studies, with which I am now associated. Only recently, I must admit, and I'm quite a novice in this area at this time. I'm trying to learn, but I'm not here as an expert by any means. The Center for Settlement Studies at the University of Manitoba, which was referred to, has set out to study, as it says, the conditions of living, the factors relating to the quality of living in resource frontier communities. And the focus of our study is not so much on the far northern Arctic communities as it is on the communities in the middle north or in the resorts frontier. And a number of these are, of course, springing up across the continent. Though much has been written on the social and psychological considerations in urban planning and community development in the South, relatively few studies to date have focused attention on these aspects of community design in the North. And experience has shown that the uniqueness of many aspects of the social and psychological milieu of far northern communities rules out any direct application to northern town sites of many southern design concepts. An increasing body of research is currently being launched by several agencies in Canada with an aim toward acquiring a better understanding of the human conditions in isolated northern settlements. Now, ours is an interdisciplinary research center. I hesitate using the word interdisciplinary. It can lead one into all kinds of problems. But we do have about 7 departments from the university involved in the research. But each project, before it is funded and supported by the center, must somehow show that it bears upon factors relating to quality of life that will somehow affect the employer and his family in the community. We have departments of economics, anthropology, sociology, home economics. Even the Department of School of Pharmacy came in with a project, city planning, architecture, and I hope horticulture before long will become involved. And ultimately, we hope, if this is at all possible, after a certain number of years, to be able to try to abstract certain principles, if you like, of human settlements. Now, whether we'll ever get this far or not, we're not sure. With this background concerning the center as such, I'll skip a lot of pages here in which I was giving it a little fuller treatment.